Hello, this time on SITREP, Mr. Starmer goes to Brussels.
We want to deliver an ambitious UK-EU security partnership to bolster NATO, covering military technology and R&D, improving the mobility of forces across Europe, and deepening our industrial collaboration.
But we have questions. Could deeper defence ties with Brussels help our military capability? Does the EU want the same as us? And have we heard all these words before but seen no action? We'll also hear from a snowy Estonia and British troops who are on NATO's largest winter exercise. And 25 years on, former Defence Secretary Geoff Hoon lifts the lid on an historic decision that changed military life for a swathe of service personnel and opened the door for thousands to follow.
SITREP
with Kate Chabot and James Hurst.
Right, well, Mike is out today, so SITREP editor James Hurst has stepped in, my partner in crime for the week. James, 15 years we've been working together, and the will-they-won't-they conversations about the EU taking on a bigger defence role seem to come round pretty regularly, don't they?
They do, and you know, it feels like they don't really go anywhere in that time. I mean, what people are talking about right now is not what it often ends up being, at least in the newspapers, the spectre of an EU army. I think, you know, what is interesting, though, is it does feel like there is more momentum, more motivation than those previous conversations we've had for the EU alongside NATO to try to pull together and get better bang for buck on defence, to coordinate better. And the reason it feels to me like there is more drive and more motivation is because of where we are now. The ground is different. We've got what's happened in Ukraine. We've got Trump 2.0, and I think a lot of European leaders are seeing, you know, the tremors from that being higher on the Richter scale than last time round. But also what's interesting, you see Germany as in the last few years, you know, Germany's such a big driving force in the EU, really ramping up its defence. So I think you're seeing that kind of push from individual countries. And most, perhaps importantly, you've got a defence and security commissioner has just been appointed within the European Union for the first time. So you've actually got someone to drive it. Now, from the UK perspective, this is interesting because we're having this conversation from outside for the first time. Mm. It's interesting to see our defence capability being held out as a carrot to Brussels, but there's that need to maintain for the government, while they want to have closer ties and see this as a carrot, maintain that narrative of it being part of the UK taking back control. So I think there is more momentum to achieving something, but achieving something useful, who knows?
Okay, well, let's expand on all of this. And to make sense of it all is Ed Arnold, former British infantry officer, now senior research fellow for European security at the defence think tank RUSI. Ed, good to see you again. Thanks for joining us on SITREP. Can you just start by giving us a quick overview of what the EU already does on defence?
Yes, of course. I mean, the EU's structures, I mean, the current structure in terms of their operations, what is a CSDP, Common Security and Defence Policy, was actually something that the UK and France set up in 1998 under our Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair. So actually the UK knows these instruments very, very well. And they are missions that are generally focused on crisis management, quite a lot of civilian and military missions, and probably more maritime missions than missions on land. And they're very much focused on stabilisation, training and assist. So not in the same way that NATO has been engaged more recently in Libya and Afghanistan, and also in terms of what NATO does in terms of deterrence and defence in Europe. What has changed quite significantly in the last couple of years, and actually since Brexit, is the EU looking more to do capability development. The issue around capability development on the EU is always a question, well, what's it for? So ultimately, what is the EU in terms of defence and security for? And it's always this difficulty of aligning the financial instruments that the EU could bring to bear on this with making sure that everything is streamlined, not just with the EU, but also NATO as well, to make Europe more secure.
James, what is Keir Starmer's ambition here, though, for greater UK-EU defence cooperation?
It's very light on detail, frankly, if any detail. What Downing Street tells us was said at this EU dinner that he was at was the sort of five areas he talked about are improving military mobility and logistics, so our ability to actually get troops across Europe. We've talked about that before, and we've seen big NATO exercises sort of testing that before, so that's not a new idea. Working more closely on missions. I mean, I think Ed's sort of set out quite clearly there's a narrower range of type of mission that the EU's been involved in the past. Protection from state threats and sabotage. I mean, I think, you know, this is one that has come to the top of the agenda. But I think actually the one that sort of stands out as being most EU is things like developing military technology, deepening industrial collaboration. You know, it's more about getting to the stage of operating. As I say, I can't see any detail in there. The ideas have been talked about before, but I'm it's not yet clear what the practical reality of doing better London thinks is the way forward here.
So, Ed, if it's not clear what the Prime Minister wants from a defence pact with the EU, what do you think he should want? What actually is in the UK's interest here to maximise our defence capability?
Well, I think what the Prime Minister wants, it's got to be seen in the wider context within Europe. And I think, I mean, what's been in the news this week is partly saying that, well, defence and security is potentially a low-hanging fruit because it has been talked about since Brexit and there's been some changes. I kind of disagree on that because obviously, like James says, if this is going to be substantive and of value, then you shouldn't see it as a low-hanging fruit and you should see that there's potential ambition there. But I see this more as political, as a sort of a process in terms of wider UK-EU reset and alignment than just in particular on defence and security. Because from the UK, I mean, there's other mechanisms that we do a lot of this through already. I mean, principally through NATO, also in terms of the Joint Expeditionary Force, and also bilaterally and trilaterally with our allies. So actually, when you interrogate it in the five priority areas that we now have that we sort of haven't been articulated in the sort of 6 months since the election, it is still also very difficult to see where those areas are critical to the UK and potentially also critical to the EU. And that's going to have to go through that sort of period of negotiation.
And in that light, where do the UK's and the EU's interests align?
Well, I think on a whole host of issues, it depends where you actually see those threats. So, I mean, taking state threats and sabotage, and, you know, we're seeing a lot of activity now in a variety of guises, particularly, for example, critical underwater infrastructure. But when you just take that problem set, I mean, NATO set up two more coordination cells. The GEF has an ambition to do critical underwater protection for the UK and its allies. And the EU also has resilience in terms of strategic compass. So it's very difficult from an organisational point of view to see, well, who leads on this, where and what. So actually, in terms of a UK-EU reset, I think actually what needs to happen, probably in conjunction, but you need to get a little bit of white smoke first on, is actually what the NATO and the EU is going to cooperate on to see where the UK can plug in, because these are all very sensible areas. But actually, when you interrogate them on each one, so let's take, for example, military mobility and logistics, which is a PESCO project under the EU. Actually, a lot of that is about improving infrastructure within Europe. So is the UK going to put money into improving bridges in Poland? Probably not. What it means for the UK is, can we actually get the soldiers, the people over west to east? And that is all about, you know, a Schengen deal and paperwork and passports. That's very different to actually what the rest of the program's about. So when you interrogate each in separate, every detail, it is actually quite a challenge to work out why this should be ambitious rather than just actually quite routine and fairly basic.
Yeah, and James, of course, the perennial question is NATO. I mean, that's what NATO's for, all of this, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, you know, listening to what Ed lists there, and I'm reminded of what Mike talks about so often in terms of this sense that the US, be it under Trump or somebody else, is going to be putting less attention into Europe. And what he says goes are the enablers of operations. You know, NATO, I don't think anybody's talking about the EU becoming the pointy bit and leading those sharp operations. But actually, number one, can the EU, by getting everybody together, add value and help replace those enablers that might be withdrawn by the US? But number two, also, can in this climate the EU have these conversations, recognizing that not every EU member is a NATO member, but can it have these conversations in the EU forum and then take a more unified voice to NATO meetings where European and American interests don't so much align as we go over time? I think that is the case that will be made by supporters of this greater European defence cooperation. There will be voices, and there will be voices particularly in the UK who get concerned, and there will be voices in NATO who get concerned. It's about adding value rather than doubling up and replacing, if you're going to do it right.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. This is, you know, much broader coordination, like I said, just not just a UK-EU question, but a wider European question. And the issue on the EU side that I think that they could make a lot of difference in now is defence industrial cooperation and collaboration. If it sort of goes into hyperdrive compared to what it's been fairly recently, I mean, there's a lot of bottom-up projects under PESCO, Permanent Structured Cooperation, which is far better than the sort of top-down methodology that the EU previously used. So it's the right idea. But I mean, it started off as around 20 projects. It's now ballooned to sort of 64. And when you look at the yearly reports, I mean, some maybe half of them are potentially viable. So it's something that if they actually stripped it out and probably looked at the war in Ukraine and said, actually, these things don't matter anymore. We need to sort of kill these off and reinvest in other areas. I think that would be incredibly valuable. And then also from the European Defence Agency perspective, the EU still does requirement setting, whereas actually NATO does that as well, and NATO standardisation is far better. I mean, as an example that we always use is Europe operates 17 different types of main battle tank. So that's 17 different supply chains, 17 different logistics arrangements, 17 different sorts of spare parts, which is very difficult when you get a fighter's probably an alliance of 32. So if the EU can use its military muscle and start to really influence those types of things and say, look, this is too federated, it's silly, let's just focus on these certain areas, which is also in lockstep with NATO. That would actually be very effective. As soon as you then start to put the money into these systems and ramp up production, and that is where the UK could make a difference, getting more bang for the buck in terms of, you know, increasing those things, for example, artillery barrels, artillery ammunition, those things that you actually need a lot of that we don't have at the moment.
Yeah, so that's a starting point that you outlined there. Where does it go from here, Ed? What do you see as the potential?
So I think, you know, there's a political element of this first in terms of that wider reset. And it's also noteworthy that, you know, the new bilateral relations with Germany, for example, the Trinity House Agreement that was signed in October, that has been pushed as sort of part of that wider reset. And also increasing bilateral relations will help on the EU side. It's also slightly broader in terms of key personalities. So the new Secretary General of NATO is the first member from an EU member state in a decade, and the chances of greater NATO-EU collaboration there, pretty specific. And then also you're looking at the UK side. I mean, yes, there's a new EU Commissioner for Defence and Space from Lithuania, but also Kaja Kallas, previous Estonian Prime Minister, who is now the EU's top diplomat and will probably push foreign policy in a very different direction. So you've got to see that the personalities, and I think the UK could work with that. I mean, Kaja Kallas is a Europhile. Estonia is the location of the UK battle group, a NATO battle group. That said, there's also issues on the EU side because there's a lot of elections coming up. So, for example, France presidential election 2027. I mean, you know, the French is, you know, have serious political issues between the far right and centrist parties. So that can change the makeup of the EU quite considerably and quite quickly. And that could actually hamper their own efforts in terms of defence. So this is something that politically has to be managed quite well.
Ed Arnold, really good to have you on SITREP. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Well, whatever deals European leaders do on defence cooperation, NATO remains very much the pointy end of the spear for our collective defence. And since Ed mentions it, let's talk about Estonia right now. Hundreds of British troops, along with tanks and armoured vehicles, are in the snowy woodlands of eastern Estonia for the Alliance's biggest winter exercise.
Well, at the minute, we're going head-to-head with the Americans, so practising using like hunter-killer tactics, so pushing forward and stuff. It's quite good fun. We play hunter with that, like, we got better sights than the Challenger too, so we go ahead and then spot the Bradleys, what we've been doing today. And then the Charlie 2s normally come and destroy them, or if it's bigger tanks and stuff.
Here we've got lots of tracks in very dense wood blocks. That doesn't give us a lot of opportunity to spread out, and we're quite channeled down certain routes, and that's just a different way of fighting, and they're learning to adapt.
It's really important to learn the terrain. It's really important to learn the skill set of operating in these conditions. So the ability for our soldiers to survive, to fight, to operate in these conditions is absolutely paramount.
Well, that is a taste of exercise winter camp from some of the soldiers of the Royal Dragoon Guards who are taking part. And BFBS Forces news reporter David Civils McCann has been with them for part of the exercise. David, good to see you. It's kind of a giant game of cat and mouse that you were watching.
Essentially, yes. The main aim of the Royal Dragoon Guards is to develop their ability to operate in this part of Eastern Europe. As the name of the exercise suggests, it's about developing their cold weather resilience. It can get down to around minus 20, although it has been a relatively mild winter this year. But it's also about developing that hunt and kill capability in this terrain, using the Warriors and the Bulldog armoured vehicles to their full capability in the dense woodlands around Tapa training area to locate and engage a peer enemy. This, of course, is vital with Estonia being right next to NATO's largest current security threat, so that capability is key for securing the eastern flank. The Baltic states are relatively small nations, and we were told that the feeling in Estonia itself is that it's a case of when Russia will invade, not if it invades. So making sure that the alliance can operate and protect its members in that part of Europe is very important. But this wasn't just about the cavalry troops, this was a multinational battle group deployment to ensure the various parts of the force can work together effectively.
Yeah, multinational. So who else was involved? How big an exercise is it?
Well, it's a significant deployment. 900 UK troops taking part alongside 230 French personnel and 130 vehicles. And it wasn't just the cavalry soldiers from the UK, members of the Royal Engineers, Royal Artillery, REMI, keeping everything moving in the challenging terrain. Also the local Estonian troops forming part of the mission, using their knowledge of the battle area and the terrain to help the Allies operate. US forces deployed as well. You heard them there at the start with their HIMAR rocket launchers. They're an absolutely awesome sight when they're firing. We were a good distance away from them because you have to, but you got a sense of their power and effectiveness on the battlefield.
And it's an annual exercise, Dave. So what's the particular aim this year?
Well, it's about learning how to take the job they do day in, day out, and make sure they can do it in that part of the world effectively. The Royal Dragoon Guards, for example, were testing out recce tactics in the forest, different methods. One company were using drones to seek out the enemy, while the other conducted the same mission without them, just to see what would work better. And while they are being used effectively in some battle environments, it's about seeing if they would bring that significant advantage to this type of warfare. I remember being with the enemy warriors in the forest and seeing a reconnaissance drone coming over, and it just simply alerted them that they'd been detected and they moved to a different location. And of course, what we are seeing in the war in Ukraine is having a big influence. Like Ukraine, Estonia shares a border with Russia. Attack drones have been a huge feature of the war in Ukraine, and that's prompted a bit of a rethink when it comes to air defence. In most recent conflicts, the UK has enjoyed air superiority, but with these attack drones, which are cheap and relatively easy for someone to fly, doing some serious damage to forces in Ukraine, it's prompted a bit of a fresh focus on the importance of air defence for any force, as Bombardier Keto Codrington of the 12th Royal Artillery told me.
In 2025, I don't think there's anything more important than air defence. Everyone's seen the news and seen the threats that we face today, and we've seen kind of in the Russian invasion of Ukraine, in the first few days, they went after only air defence. So the life expectancy of some of these guys operating, it may not be the best, but they'll do their job regardless. So in 2025, we really ought to be woven into every aspect of planning. We should be pretty much tied into every bit of it.
This is part of a refocus in the British Army after 2 decades of largely desert warfare and hot temperatures. It's about focusing on a new threat and a new theatre. It's about refocusing on operating in a land war in Eastern Europe and being able to keep a force effective in cold weather. The war in Ukraine is giving the UK and NATO allies an idea of the issues they could face, so it's about making sure they're trained to deal with them.
Yeah, and at the other end of the technology scale, Dave, it's also trying and testing tactics for trench warfare, which I guess was a fairly new experience for a lot of those taking part.
Yes, trench warfare is something that's made a bit of a comeback in the last few years. I was talking to some of the soldiers from both the British and French armies, and most were saying it's not something they really expected they would have to deal with when they joined, something many of them learned about at school as part of their history class. But again, it's what we're seeing in Ukraine, so it's vital they get used to that challenging battle space. We were able to follow some of the soldiers from the French army as they made their way through the trench system in Tapan, and they told us just how they operate in that environment.
When we are fighting in the trench, we need to be focused on the face when we are progressing in the trench, but we have to put some covers on the sides. We have to look a lot around us. We have to go really quickly, because this is really risky to stay in the same position.
This is a new wave, a new combat for us, and I never think that I've done this one day. By meeting the Estonian soldier and the British soldier, we can exchange our feeling to touch about us.
In essence, the exercise is about ensuring these troops can operate effectively if NATO's security was threatened. Estonia is a small country and is relatively vulnerable to a much larger aggressive neighbour. We've seen what's happened in Ukraine, but Estonia is a NATO member and will be protected if its security is threatened. That means countries like the UK, France, the US, alongside others in the alliance, must know not only how to work with the Estonian forces, but each other, to ensure they can work effectively to guarantee Estonia's security, as well as just learn to simply fight and operate there.
And Dave, I was really interested that you said earlier on that this year the actual temperatures were warmer than they usually are. Did that make much of a difference to the exercise?
Well, I think it does make a slight difference to mobility. We saw a few vehicles being recovered rather than the snow covering that you would get in sort of minus 20 temperatures. We were seeing a lot of sheet ice, which obviously it's very hard for the vehicles to get the traction there. So yeah, I think it does pose some challenges when it's slightly warmer, when it's hovering around freezing and getting that a little bit warmer. But they have to operate in all kind of conditions there. It's vital that they just learn to overcome these challenges to ensure they can secure NATO's eastern flank.
David, really good to speak to you. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Well, we finished this week with a bit of military history, very recent military history, though. LGBT History Month this year coincides almost exactly with the 25th anniversary of the lifting of the ban which barred gay and bisexual people from serving in the UK's armed forces. Decades of official persecution and harassment, which had ended careers in disgrace and even prison, was brought to an end. The ban replaced by a code of social conduct for all, regardless of sexuality, but only after the government had fought and lost a 3-year legal battle. At that time, Craig Jones was junior officer in the Navy, hiding his relationship with another man and living a double life, while Ed Hall, who'd already been kicked out of the senior service for being gay, was a leading figure in the fight against the ban.
We would have, you know, recently retired senior three stars, you know, who'd obviously been briefed by the MOD, coming up to pitch their argument for them. Occasionally we got ministers who would also say that, you know, that there was no way that people serving in the armed forces was compatible with military service. You know, we had, you know, very recently retired Air Chief Marshals, you know, talking about, you know, not wanting to share a shower with people who were gay. And, you know, there was, it was whipping up the worst kind of homophobic hysteria, or trying to.
And I remember sitting in the officer's mess of the carrier, and the first Sea Lord of the day had written an open letter in either the Daily Express or the Mail. And the headline was, "I will never serve with queers and lesbians." And I sat with a group of my peers, a group of lieutenants, and I felt incredibly exposed. And I remember with great clarity, somebody directly asked me in that conversation, and I said, "I also hope we never have to serve with those people." And quite soon after that, I left the table, I went up to my cabin, and I wept. And I vowed to myself on that day that however difficult the circumstances, I would never, ever lie again.
Extremely powerful testimony there. And those opposed to lifting the ban argued that it would damage morale, team cohesion and operational effectiveness. It seemed that the government of the time was persuaded of those arguments and only lifted the ban because it was forced to. But today, 25 years on, we get new insights into how the decision was taken. Jeff Hoon was the Defence Secretary who announced the rule change. And for the first time, he has talked publicly about his part in that historic moment.
I'm a lawyer by training and background, and in a sense, leaving aside the rights and wrongs of the issue, I knew as a lawyer that we had to implement the judgment of the European Court, and I really never gave it a further thought than that, because in a sense, for a country like the United Kingdom, following those judgments is vitally important.
We know there were quite a lot of vocal opponents to lifting the ban. I think a lot of that came from within the service community and perhaps service chiefs. Can you tell us a little bit about the meetings you were having? I appreciate you were not Defence Secretary when the ruling was made, but in that sort of 3 months that follows, you must have had to have discussions with the people that were running the armed forces. What kind of messages and noises were they providing you?
Well, I should give credit, first of all, to George Robertson, who was my predecessor. He was the one who started the process as far as the discussions in the MOD were concerned. And he was the one who probably had the more difficult conversations initially, if there were difficult conversations. As far as I was concerned, the conversations I had were in preparation for the statement. The decision, in principle, had been taken. It was simply a question of how we applied that decision in practice.
Why didn't Labour lift the ban in 1997 when it came to power?
I can't answer that in truth, because I was in a completely different government department at the time. What I knew was that it was necessary for us to act on the decision of the European Court of Human Rights.
One of the veterans that we spoke to was outed by a tabloid newspaper right at the end of 1996. And the subsequent process that was put on him lasted the election period and into 1997 and into New Labour. And he hoped for a while that his career in the Royal Air Force would be saved and his livelihood would be intact. Obviously, that didn't come to pass. He felt disappointed by that.
I can understand that, but as I say, I wasn't in the MOD at the time and therefore not really in a position to comment as to what was going on at the time.
Is there any regret that, not necessarily during your watch, but the Ministry of Defence defended the ban in all the courts it was able to do so and ultimately lost?
I think it's one of these issues that over time we look back over 25 years and wonder, why on earth wasn't this done before? It's so obvious that this decision should have been taken. It's quite hard to put yourself back into the position that people were in at the time. And I don't want to criticise the past in that sense, because it's gone, it's done. But it is one of those, and there are a number of these kinds of decisions these days, where I look back and think, well, why on earth wasn't that done before?
And I suppose then, is there any feeling by you, or do you think by your contemporaries from then, that it's regretful that Labour didn't lift the ban because they wanted to, they lifted the ban because they were forced to?
I think that's a fair observation, and I accept the implied criticism that flows from that. But at the same time, I'm confident that even without the decision of the European Court of Justice, we would have got there. Because, again, Labour took a number of decisions in government during that period that were difficult as far as some aspects of society were concerned, but were necessarily right to move the country forward.
Some of the remarks you were faced with that day when you lifted the ban in your statement were, you know, quite offensive, I think, to LGBT people who might have been listening, or to LGBT veterans who might look back on the tape. Do you think those individuals look, I'm going to say, a bit silly now? You know, in one instance, someone was saying this is going to be a military ruinous act. You know, I mean, the fact is the armed forces, you know, there was no impact on the operational effectiveness of the armed forces because you lifted the ban.
None whatsoever. And indeed, I think that was more than anything what we had in mind, in the sense that what we wanted to ensure was the continuation of the contribution that many people from that background provided. And we wanted their service, we wanted their expertise, we wanted them to remain committed members of the armed forces.
It is that lower generation, younger generation, perhaps, that come into the armed forces, it being a conveyor belt of talent, that perhaps sort of really embrace and bring about change. And, you know, I know for a fact there are people serving today who are 25 years old, lance corporals in infantry battalions, who are out and proud about their sexualities, and they almost can't believe that this past is within reach of theirs.
And I see that with my own children. They take for granted issues that perhaps for my parents' generation were extremely difficult. And I'm pleased that my generation was able to make a change and create a situation in which, frankly, no one cares.
That was the former Defence Secretary Geoff Hoon talking to BFBS Forces News reporter James Wharton. James has spoken to a number of the key figures involved in that historic moment. They have incredibly powerful and moving stories, and you can see his full film. It's called The Forgotten Battle on the BFBS Forces News YouTube channel now. Well, let's bring SITREP's James Hurst back in. James, it was clearly a big deal for people affected by the ban. How big a deal was it for everybody else at the time?
I mean, it was a huge national debate. I mean, this was half my lifetime ago. I was at the start of my career and living for the first time in a military city. I was living and working in Plymouth around that time. And, you know, there were strong feelings in both directions. I was actually doing a radiophonium program, and the switchboard would light up every time this came on. I think what's interesting, I mean, you look within, I think, probably days of Geoff Hoon's announcement, you had an army brigadier who resigned, who felt so strongly about this that he said, I'm not going to continue to serve. But what I think is interesting is James, you know, quite rightly pointed in that interview with Geoff Hoon to the legacy of the service test that was introduced to assess what personal relationships and behaviours were or weren't appropriate. And that still stands today. And actually, you know, that kind of tidied up some ends for all sorts of situations. Let me give you just one anecdote, though. A friend of mine, he was an army doctor. I've got quite a lot of friends who worked in the hospital, and a number of them were military medics. I was out with that group on a Saturday night, and that Saturday night out ended up in Plymouth's gay club. And on the Monday morning, he was called in to see his commanding officer. He was out with his girlfriend.
Right.
I think I was the only gay person in that party. He was called in to see his commanding officer to be told he had been reported for being in this club. And he said, well, I'm not gay, so what's your problem? And his CEO said, it's not an appropriate place for you to be seen.
Yeah.
You know, that was the culture at the time. So ultimately, it did affect people beyond. But see, for some people, it felt like a negative effect, and they felt like they had to step out of the service at the
and
time.
And it's really interesting hearing that anecdote, James, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, and also hearing Jeff Hoon talk about it now with the benefit of everything that's gone since, and saying that really it was pretty obvious it had to change. And we're talking about a single moment in time then, but it's more than just that event. It's a process, isn't it?
Yes, I think it was the Chief of Defence Staff at the time, BFPS, asked him, you know, what is this going to change? And he said, right, it's going to change very little. And it's funny because in a way he was right. You know, nothing changed overnight, but for some people it changed everything.
Interesting, yeah.
I mean, people like Craig Jones literally came out within hours of that being lifted. But what really matters is, and I think we've talked about this before in different situations, it's changing the rules versus changing the culture.
Mm.
And they both affect each other. And there's a sense maybe that the culture was starting to change, and that enables the rule change, but the rule change enables further culture change. I think the next important step was when the UK introduced civil partnerships in 2005, actually the armed forces who had to get their ducks in a row, because they had to look and say, well, hang on, these are relationships that the UK treats as equivalent to marriage, and all of a sudden they had to decide, and same-sex couples got access to military housing. I think it, you know, really important was the step the Navy took, a world first in 2006, in saying, if we're marching in pride, we're doing it in uniform. It took the Army and RAF a couple more years to get the courage to do that. But the Navy were the ones who took the step and said, we're not just tolerating, we're accepting, we're celebrating. And for me, fast forward to 2013, I mean, this rule change enabled me to do my job, in a sense, because as a civilian subject to service discipline. But fast forward to 2013...
You wouldn't be here now, is that what you're saying?
No, in a sense.
Really?
But fast forward to 2013, I remember being stood waiting to get a helicopter, and somebody I knew quite well, worked with quite a lot out there, asked me, you know, had I ever considered joining up? And I said, well, you know, back when I was... I said, no, because actually it would have been illegal for me to join up when I was of joining age. And it took him half a second to process... You know, 13 years on, culture has really... culture change takes time, but it's all in that moment.
And thank heavens those rules changed. Otherwise, I wouldn't have had 15 years of working with James Hirst. James, thank you so much for being my partner in crime today on SITREP.
You're welcome.
Thanks to all of our guests. We're wishing Professor Michael Clark a speedy recovery. He should be back with me for another SITREP next Thursday. In the meantime, you can stay up to date with all the latest defence news on our website, forcesnews.com. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.